Hello there, ladies and gents. Welcome to Orwellian Optics, a podcast by Alio Capital, where we explore the intersection of macroeconomics, policy, politics, and particularly how they affect your wallet and your personal finances. I'm your host, Joseph Grenante. I'm here with our Chief Investment Officer, AJ Giannone. AJ, introduce yourself.
I'm AJ Giannone, CFA and Chief Investment Officer here at Alio Capital. In each episode, we're going to dive into how macroeconomics and portfolio management are the key drivers of how you take control of your financial future. Chris?
Thanks, AJ. I'm Chris Morgan, Chief Operating Officer here at Alio Capital, and really excited to be bringing the whys of policy to everybody. Why do we make certain policy decisions and how do they impact economics and ultimately financial markets? So, Joseph, I know we want to talk a little bit about a recent interview with Kamala Harris, so I will pass it over to you to kick off a little conversation about that.
Yeah, guys, the reason why we're diving into politics here is because most people think politics and economics are separate, but really economic freedom is the prerequisite to political freedom. And it's monetary and fiscal policy that drive the six determinants that affect the assets in your portfolio. The six determinants are high growth, low growth, high inflation, low inflation, credit spread, and the risk premium. So that said, we're going to take a look at this last interview with Kamala Harris. She doesn't really face the public much, and transparency is key in a free republic. So I think CNN did a decent job with this interview.
Hundreds of people a day were dying because of COVID. The economy had crashed. In large part, all of that because of mismanagement by Donald Trump of that crisis. When we came in, our highest priority was to do what we could to rescue America. And today, we know that we have inflation at under 3%. A lot of our policies have led to the reality that America recovered faster than any wealthy nation around the world. But you are right. Prices, in particular for groceries, are still too high. The American people know it, I know it, which is why my agenda includes what we need to do to bring down the price of groceries. For example, dealing with an issue like price gouging, what we need to do to extend the child tax credit to help young families be able to take care of their children in their most formative years, what we need to do to bring down the cost of housing. My proposal includes what would be a tax credit of $25,000 for first-time home buyers so they can just have enough to put a down payment on a home, which is part of the American dream and their aspiration, but do it in a way that allows them to actually get on the path to achieving that goal and that dream.
So you have been vice president for 3.5 years.
Yeah.
The steps that you're talking about now, why haven't you done them already?
Interesting, to say the least. One thing that I found from that interview, she kind of owned Bidenomics. She didn't say she was going to change any of the policies that have not been working up until now. And then she said she wants to strengthen the middle class. So how do you think she combines those two with policies that clearly aren't working to strengthen the middle class, the stated objective of doing so?
Yeah, well, I think, first off, what are the two things that affect the middle class the most, right? One is open borders. It's been the worst regime in history as far as immigration is concerned. When you take in people that are net debtors, and that's what you do, if you look at countries, I believe in a very Scandinavian-like model. If you look at countries like Norway, Sweden, Denmark, they only take in people that are going to contribute to the pie and grow the pie. By just having unfettered open borders, what that's doing, it's artificially keeping wages down. I mean, Bernie Sanders is on record saying open borders is a Koch brothers conspiracy. Open borders started under Ronald Reagan. And so that's why you see a lot of the Bush staffers, the McCain staffers, and the Romney staffers backing Harris, because she's essentially a neocon. I mean, maybe technically a neolib, but some of the best scholars, nobody could ever explain the difference between what's a neolib and a neocon, because there is no difference, right? It's just different terms and two feathers of the same bird. So with AJ, what do you think about some of her statements there on strengthening the middle class and doubling down on Biden economics?
Well, you hit the nail on the head there, Joseph. The open border policy, I think if you unpack that a little bit and you look at it in concert with the economic conditions that have prevailed for the last 4 years, specifically the high inflation mandate, there's certainly an argument to be made that the open border policy has been a Biden administration band-aid for the inflation, in effect, bringing in a flux of low-wage workers to try to keep inflation under control, where Bidenomics has realistically, with both hand over fist, just contributed to the excesses that we've seen in inflation over and above what we would have seen just from a monetary policy perspective. And even leaving that aside, I mean, the safety aspect here is a huge piece of it. I mean, you go back to the core function of what the federal government is supposed to provide for its citizens: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the amount of negligence that you have to, I don't even know the right word, but like to let a completely unguarded border remain open with documented cases of people coming into this country with criminal records, with certainly nefarious purposes. Not everyone, obviously, but there are undoubtedly people in the mass of millions of people who have now crossed the border over the last 4 years who, like you said, are A, not only not additive to the pie, but actively detracting from the pie. So I think both of those things are going to be very difficult to reconcile with the quote-unquote Bidenomics. I mean, if you make the argument that Bidenomics is supposed to be additive to the middle class, you have to be able to draw a link between any one of the policies in particular that are a part of Bidenomics and some amount of productivity growth, some amount of direct government support, or some amount of just general welfare and being better off than you were 4 years ago. And I think she's going to have a hard time getting more specific than that, because between the three of us, I don't think any of us can point to a particular policy or objective that has benefited the middle class. I mean, can you guys?
I can't. And I think you also pointed out to, you know, some of the nefarious activity you have. I mean, FBI is on record saying that, you know, we're at a massively heightened risk of terrorist activity because you have people crossing the border that are linked to Chinese nationalists. You have people linked to Al-Qaeda, people linked to Hamas. But I want to just show this clip.
Headlines, of course, all over the country, where the mayor of Aurora says Venezuelan gangs are overrunning apartment buildings.
The job of the federal government is to protect its citizens. And so when it's completely unfettered and unchecked the way it is, I can't think of a greater act of treason or betrayal to the citizens that they represent. I mean, this is a republic, right? And I think the citizens who are there letting down the most, it's not even just the middle class, but it's the poor, it's the working poor, because they are prioritizing giving resources to these migrants over, say, people that have been on the Section 8 list for years and, you know, in cities like Chicago and cities like Albuquerque and Houston. And so it really affects the people at the bottom the most. And of course, the middle class, because it artificially drives wages down. If you just look at who their backers are, well, then you can understand why they're doing this, right? When you look at the Democratic Party, they outraise the Republican Party almost 3-4 to 1 because they are the party of billionaires. The paradigm has shifted. And so it used to be that the Republicans represented big money interests. And now, because of Donald Trump disrupting the system so much, it's now the Democratic Party that represents those interests, because he basically wiped out the neocons from the Republican Party back in 2016 when he defeated the frontrunner at that time, was Jeb Bush. So, you know, with that, I want to kick it over to Chris Morgan here and see what other questions he has.
It's just wild to me to think about. Like, it's more than ignorance, right? It's almost worse than ignorance. It's nefarious. Both of you made a really good point that the job of the government is to protect the citizens. That's why we pay our taxes, to make our lives better. When they're willfully allowing these folks in at the expense of our citizens, it really makes you wonder why. What's going on there under the scenes, behind the scenes, that we don't know about? Not just adding to voter registers, not just adding to pocketbooks. There's another why there. I don't know what it is. AJ, do you have a thought?
Well, absolutely. And all it takes is a critical analysis. I mean, people are rational actors, especially at that level. To get to that level in politics, you have to, regardless of your political affiliation or what image you present through the media, you have to be ruthlessly efficient at making decisions. So, you know, when you look at the why for why these decisions are being made, it's either one or two things. It's because they personally believe that this is advantageous for their political career and future job prospects as they transition to the private sector of, you know, highly paid consultancy, or because they're directly receiving some sort of benefit through a campaign contribution, or again, a promise of a future directorship or board seat at some massive conglomerate that these billionaires own and control. So to me, it's fairly easy to draw a straight line from A to B there. But Joseph, is there anything else we're missing?
You hit the nail on the head, but, you know, specifically just follow the money. I mean, Donald Trump is the only president in the past 40 years that has left office poorer than when he entered office. Yet you look at people like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and how much personal enrichment they have gained, not just in the form of campaign contributions, but their overall net worth. And this is, we have a rancid government, to be clear, on both sides of the aisle. We are not a right-leaning company. We are an independent libertarian-leaning company. But libertarian, really, people tend to affiliate libertarian, you know, with right-wing politics, but it's really not the case. I mean, if you look at somebody like Dennis Kucinich, he would be a left-leaning libertarian. I mean, they gerrymandered him out of the Democratic Party, right? Because he wanted to represent the interests of the people. And I think you just got to follow the money trail. And when Barack Obama, who's never held an actual job in his life other than community organizer, which we don't have time to get into it, but if you understood the Alinsky model and Rules for Radicals, you'd understand what community organizer means. I implore you to take a look at Rules for Radicals. But yeah, he bought a $44 million mansion in Martha's Vineyard. And yet Michelle Obama at the DNC said she's suspicious of the rich. So when you tie it back to this interview, and again, the name of this podcast is Orwellian Optics, it's really this dystopian left is right, up is down model. And they're the ones, the Democrats, that drive division. She kept saying Donald Trump wants to divide the country. No, Donald Trump created a rising tide, and a rising tide lifts all boats. We had a great economy. We had the border under control. There were no wars going on. And I think when you go back to this paradigm shift, I mean, Donald Trump was pursuing world peace. You know, he was negotiating with people like Kim Jong-un. Now the Biden administration, it's exponentially worse for the middle class, exponentially worse for the lower class. We have two wars going on, and this is what the big money interest wants. So you have to believe your eyes. And that's why, again, why we call this Orwellian optics, because we're trying to get you to see through propaganda, if you will, for what it is. So in this interview, she also talked about COVID, and they tried to take credit for all these jobs that Trump created. They go back to COVID and they say, oh, you know, it destroyed the economy and all these people who are at work, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, all they did was put people back to work. To be clear, Donald Trump created all those millions of jobs, right? With the Jobs Act of 2017, they didn't get much into it in this interview, but in the Democratic National Convention, you know, where they talked about Donald Trump giving tax breaks to his Wall Street and corporate donors. But if you look at where that money went and who benefited, it was the middle class that benefited the most. So she's saying things here and it's just rhetoric, but you got to look beyond the rhetoric and look at the policies and see the results of those policies. So no, they didn't create those jobs. They put people back to work, and Donald Trump created those jobs. And to be clear, when they took over, they had, I think, 1.8% inflation. So that's what the Trump administration left us with. And inflation rose because their policies, many of them were inflationary. I mean, some of it came from COVID, but then they doubled down on stupid and they exacerbated the issue. And that's why inflation was out of control. And so, you know, she's talking about inflation now being under 3%, but it's still up 30%. I mean, if you want to just look at the average metric, it's about 30% across the board. Inflation is up. And that's because of their policies. And to be clear, they didn't even get to pass Build Back Better. If they had passed Build Back Better, inflation would have been even higher. So when you look at some of the things they're proposing, the Soviet-style price controls, tax increases, all this would be inflationary. And so if they were to get control of all three branches of government, I think inflation would continue to trend upward. And with rates being cut, you could have a stagflationary environment. So with that, I want to pass it back to Chris and see what else he has to say and ask here.
Yeah, it's interesting. People don't learn from history, and history doesn't repeat itself necessarily verbatim, but it certainly mirrors itself, and we can certainly learn things. So, you know, printing money just to print money and take us out of a downturn is only going to make things work. It's going to make things more expensive. People aren't going to be making as much money. It's just common sense, it seems like. That comes around to question. It seems like since, let's say, HW, the country has been devolving into kind of sheeps who don't really think for themselves, especially when it comes to policy and what they're voting for. So if we kind of think about the country as a whole, what are some policies that would really help bring manufacturing back to the country and really strengthen our borders, strengthen us as Americans while not globalizing ourselves? What could a Republican or a Trump presidency do to actually help some of those middle-class voters?
I mean, I have my thoughts, but AJ, you want to take this question first?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you hit the nail on the head, to reuse the phrase, but the core function of what an ideal administration and a Congress would do in these next 4 years is really find a way to juice productivity growth. And not only that, but to do it in a way that is additive to America first and to the middle class. So if you look at America as an actor, you compare it to some of the different nation states that have been competitive on the world stage from a manufacturing perspective. We have to take concrete action to protect the manufacturing and the production base of this country that employs so many middle class citizens. And specifically in areas of what is now the Rust Belt and blue-collar strongholds like Michigan, Pennsylvania, these areas where people used to be able to provide for their families on a blue-collar manufacturing or production-based salary. You have to take concrete action in regards to protecting those people from the impacts of globalization in the way that other countries have done. So when you look at a country like China that has been accused of and, you know, has categorically denied but is undoubtedly pursuing actions like this, dumping raw materials on world markets, propping up domestic productions to then dump on world markets in areas like battery technology, solar panels, specifically metals and mining. So areas like coal power plants, iron production, aluminum, all of these areas are areas where if you go back to NAFTA and the whole proponent of the government pushing globalization on us as a means of making the country wealthier, you have to kind of reverse that and backtrack on some of those policies. You have to put in place controls where the government has the ability to react to nation state actors taking direct action in the market against the competitiveness of American products on the global market. So we have to ensure that when Americans go to work at a factory and when people who decide to start a business, to build something, to go compete on the world market, can put their business plan together, that their government is standing behind them, ready to support them in those endeavors and not actively trying to hinder them or put onerous regulations in place or do anything really that limits the competitiveness of American companies on the world stage. Because that's, you know, in effect, we're in the 21st century, you're competing globally, but that doesn't mean you have to hand victory over to the competitors. It means you back your strongest players, which are without a doubt the American citizens who have a work ethic that all else equal would trounce any other nation in the world. And you give them the tools that they're going to need to succeed. So that's things like a world-class education in areas where we need to be competitive. It's protecting their ability to be competitive on the world stage. It's not limiting them with respect to regulations and compliance and red tape. And it's letting them really fulfill the American dream and go out and compete and win with the support of the government and not fighting against the government.
With that point, I mean, you talked about regulations. Regulations are essentially a tax. Now, you need regulations in certain areas for sure, but excessive regulation, it just leads to attack. It raises the barrier of entry for most people into that space, right? And that's what a lot of the big players want. I mean, you could go back to Dodd-Frank, where we had six big banks. You know, they said, oh, we're going to pass this legislation to really limit the power of the banks, but they strengthened the power of the big banks. We have five now. And that's why the big players, you know, the billionaires, it's called regulatory capture. I mean, if we want to really call it for what it is, it's regulatory capture. And to give you a simple example, you know, this is looking back, but in a way that's, I think, colloquial for our audience to understand, is you could take something like Obamacare, right? And they talked about a public option, blah, blah, blah. What they essentially did was they allowed oligopolistic competition. They allowed five insurance companies to collude, set the prices, and then the government stepped in and applied this individual mandate where if you didn't buy, you were penalized and you were taxed. So this is an example of big corporations and big power working with the government to essentially control and penalize the population. And so, yeah, more people ended up having health care. And don't get me wrong, nothing is black and white. It's always gray. So, yeah, they got rid of the pre-existing condition. And, you know, that was one of the positive elements of Obamacare. But the big problem in our healthcare system is the cost, and it didn't address the cost or the quality. So the cost kept going up and the quality kept going down for the average citizen. And so what you have in the Biden administration and this potential Harris administration is an extension of Obama's presidency, where big money interests and big power will work with the government to reduce the living standards of the average citizen. And that's what we've seen over the past 4 years. And I think the point of this podcast is to get people to look at things in the most simple way. Are you better off under the Biden administration than you were under the Trump administration. And when it comes to division, that's what they specialize. They want people to vote on racial lines, on gender lines, right? And I'm somebody who identifies as non-binary, but it doesn't matter if you're straight, if you're gay, you're non-binary, you're asexual, you're black, you're white, you're green. At the end of the day, the one thing that we all have in common is we are all dependent on the economy. The economy will determine our quality of life, right? And it's pretty clear that Trump gave us a much better economy than Biden did. So back to, you know, Chris's question here is, what are those policies that are really going to strengthen America? Well, America at one point counted for 50% of the world's production, roughly. And production is what creates wealth. Well, how do you get production? Well, AJ mentioned it, right? He said education. Well, education is what leads to innovation. And so when you look at our immigration policy, a lot of times people come here and they go to our best schools. They'll go to Yale, they'll go to Harvard, and then they go back to their countries and they open up businesses and create jobs there. I'm all for immigration, but we need to restructure an immigration system where we're taking in the best and brightest, and then we incentivize them to stay here. Furthermore, when it just comes to production in general, I think imposing tariffs. Companies should not be able to have stuff made in countries where there's no labor laws, there's no labor protections, there's lower environmental standards, you know, when you talk about climate change. But see, because corporate interests control our media, you don't hear about these things where they have sneakers and computers made, you know, by child labor. And I mean, sometimes there's nets around these buildings because the people working on these conditions want to commit suicide. They prevent them from doing that by placing nets around the building. And as far as diversity, these countries have no diversity, right? So as far as like what they say their stated goals are, well, no, they essentially work for these big multinational corporations that don't really care about diversity or living standards or labor laws. What they care about is profit margins and making stuff at artificially cheap prices and then resell them here at match prices, right, to the American consumer society, right? And that's where they drive most of their profits. And so I think tariffs is one, shutting down the borders is two, because we are in this fourth leg of an industrial revolution where AI is going to eliminate millions of jobs. So the fact that we're not a manufacturing base, there's really no need to import this massive amount of immigration. And then on top of it, again, going back to the Scandinavian model, keeping corporate taxes low, which might sound contradictory, but when you think about it, right, if taxes are low, then businesses are incentivized to build here. That leads to jobs, and that actually leads to more tax revenue. And I think you can look at states like Florida, Texas, Utah, North Dakota as models of what we should do on a national scale when it comes to production and incentivizing growth and development. So with that, Chris, what else you got for us here?
Yeah, no, that's really good. There's also a national security implication when it comes to manufacturing and production, too. If we're reliant on China and Germany, other countries for our metals or plastic or whatever it is, that is a huge, huge risk that can be turned off and then we're left with nothing. So how do we increase production onshore, kind of like a World War II situation? You know, that production brought us out of the Great Depression, and hopefully it doesn't take something like that again to do it. I don't think it will.
How about antibiotics? You didn't mention antibiotics there. I mean,
yeah, any gases, you know, anything, any of these bioweapons. I mean, that is absolutely a possibility and something that has probably been tested before. So yeah, we're putting ourselves at huge risk by relying on these other global companies.
You ever wonder why pharmaceutical companies can have stuff made, right, offshore, but yet American citizens can't buy their medicines and their medical necessities from other countries?
It really pisses me off.
Well, specifically, it's a discrete example, exactly what you just said, Joseph, where the corporations are effectively writing the legislation that gets passed in this country. And for better or worse, you know, you look at the rules regulating drug companies, and they're written by lobbyists from the drug company industry. You look at defense rules and regulations, they're written by defense contractors. You look at financial regulations, they're written by ex-CEOs of Goldman Sachs. So, you know, you look around and you see this deep, incestuous relationship between government and these massive corporate interests that is specifically working to disenfranchise and disempower the American middle class and the American citizenry. And to kind of hammer this point home economically, I mean, there is an element of, I think, what needs to happen to return America to a production powerhouse that is going to be inflationary. And if you look at the CHIPS Act specifically, you cannot count on a country that is less than 100 miles from China to produce every single critical component of the brains that go into all of our most sensitive military hardware and all of our most advanced consumer and business electronics. So, you know, when you think about the process we're going to have to go through of in terms of reshoring and bringing production back to the Western Hemisphere, there's going to be an area of that that's going to be expensive and perhaps makes sense for the government to step in a way that, you know, might be inflationary. But that just hammers home the particular point that we can't be doing anything else that is also inflationary when that component is so critical. We have to be working at ensuring the American standard of living is increasing from all angles. And just saying, oh, we're bringing production back while you're doing stuff like the Inflation Reduction Act, which is, to Joseph's point, Orwellian in its name. You know, there's nothing in that act that has been, at least that I'm aware of, proven by any credible economist to have actually lowered inflation in any meaningful way.
But they said it did, AJ, so doesn't that mean it did?
Yeah, they said it would be deflationary. Just trust them. Trust them at their word.
If you see it on the internet, it must be true, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, we just have to trust it. No, it's bullshit.
I think with that point, it makes sense here, AJ. I think, you know, to talk a little bit about every week here, you know, AJ is going to give us a macro analysis for capital markets. And I think this would be a good segue into that at this time. Talk about a little bit what's going on and what's at stake, really. I mean, we're, I think, 65 days to the election. So where we're at now and what are the implications that this election could have for capital markets?
Yeah, it's a great point. And we're certainly at the precipice of an inflection point here. With the election looming large, the ability for the American economy to remain robust is going to be critically dependent on, you know, really something as simple as just the old animal spirits argument. I mean, there's certainly policy element that will come regardless of whether the government ends up being controlled in whole by one or both parties or split realistically. But the candidates, both Harris and Trump, have put out policy proposals that now are becoming quite clear. And you look at it from a policy perspective, it's not going to take much for people to realize that under a Harris administration, things like taxing unrealized capital gains, which, you know, is just a horrifically bad economic policy, even if it's for supposedly folks with a greater than 100 million net worth. I mean, that's really where all your founders are.
They always say that.
That's where it starts.
They always start there, and it always trickles down to the middle and working class, those taxes. So,
yeah, but even still, like, even if that's where it starts and ends, I mean, you know, your typical founder, your Silicon Valley founder who might employ 50, 100, 500 people, they go do a B round, now their company's worth over $100 million. They somehow have to come up with liquidity. And if you look at the analysis and some of the details, like, yeah, it's over some, you know, longer time horizon that they have to come up with this liquidity. But now, funny enough, like, guess where you've got to go get that liquidity? The banks, because now you've got restricted stock that you can't access or sell to get liquidity. So you got to go get a margin loan from a bank and you have no choice. And the banks know that. So now you're beholden to the banks again, who no doubt wrote that legislation or at least part of it. So it just ties it all, you know, in a neat bow. But to bring it back to markets for a moment, if you look at markets as primarily a psychological exercise, there's certainly an element of math behind it. But right now, the equity markets are trading at all-time highs. The valuation ratios on a per dollar of earnings basis have really never been higher. I mean, certainly there's instances like the run-up in the roaring 20s and the run-up to the tech bubble in the early 2000s and late 90s. But, you know, we're trading at 20 plus times earnings on some major equity indices, even on small cap and in some areas like value. It's certainly not cheap. So we're priced for perfection. We're priced for double-digit earnings growth. We're priced for continual GDP expansion. We're priced for inflation coming back down and staying down. And, you know, our view is that really, barring some sort of election result that would reinvigorate business investment, these are going to be high hurdles to reach. So we're proceeding very cautiously here. You know, when you look around at building a diversified portfolio in this environment, credit spreads are tight. So fixed income isn't necessarily an area to hide, especially if the Fed starts cutting rates here. There's a potential for inflation to reaccelerate. I mean, you're pouring fuel into a reaction that is not yet fully quieted down. The labor market is still relatively healthy, even though you're seeing a lack of job creation. Consumer spending is still robust, although they are in fact spending money on credit cards at an alarming rate. Credit card delinquencies are ticking up in the lower income quartiles. And additionally, delinquencies in some of those credit areas, like revolving credit and auto loans, have started to tick up as well, again, in those lower income quartiles, the ones most specifically targeted or at least affected by the high inflation that we've experienced over the last couple of years, which has dramatically put pressure on their income statements and balance sheets at the household level. So to hammer the point home, we're at the precipice of a unique turning point. Depending on which way this election goes, it'll have potentially dire and potentially dramatic consequences for the average household, not just from the perspective of, you know, what their 401k or their portfolio looks like, but really for their ability to continue to provide meaningfully for their family going forward.
I think Warren Buffett's quote is relevant here. You know, be fearful when others are greedy and be greedy when others are fearful. You know, with your points there, AJ, would you say that if Harris is elected, then it's really important to have, I mean, because you look at the debasement of our currency, you look at the fact that there's such massive dependence on China for the big corporations. And when you look at what's driven the market higher in the past year, who's done best, I would say, in the past year, right? It's the multinational FANG corporations. And some of the legislation, like you go back to Build Back Better, it would have really penalized early stage investment, raised taxes on early stage investment. And so when you tie this back to innovation and production, Harris's policies would not incentivize innovation and production. In fact, they would disincentivize them, where Trump's policies would clearly incentivize them and incentivize companies to build here. It would keep the majority of our talent here, because he wants to restructure the immigration system. So in my analysis, you know, a Trump presidency would be really bullish for equities because consumer confidence would rise, where in the Harris administration, I mean, you mentioned where we're at from a debt standpoint. I mean, if you just look at the effect that borders have on the overall debt that we're taking on. Right now, you have private debt, you have public debt, all of it is maximized. And so more regulations, more taxes, more disincentivizing growth. So people would really have to, in my opinion, have to have some exposure to gold, energy in a Harris administration, where I think in a Trump administration, I mean, you always want to have that level of diversification, but you could have less diversification. And I think it would be more bullish for equities.
I think your proposed policies are just, they're disincentivizing risk, right? You have no reason to take any risk. If you're going to have to pay an unrealized gain tax, why would you risk having unrealized gains? You know, so if we want to increase production and if we want to move forward, part of that calculation is risk, and we have to take it in order to drive growth. That's just the nature of it. So if people are unwilling to take risk and this country then becomes stagnant, things just kind of, you know, go along, people move out, there's a brain drain. This is a direct line to the collapse of our country, and think we should not be afraid to talk about it and tell people exactly what's happening. Education is key here. Really, really good conversation, guys. So, Joseph, any last thoughts on that Kamala Harris interview and how it would affect things going forward, especially for us?
Yeah, I think what people have to understand, and again, at Elio Capital, we're an investment company, but the reason why we're doing this podcast called Orwellian Optics, because what you're seeing is Orwellian optics, right? We are in this mass surveillance, digital age. And I think people have to understand that there's really no such thing as Republicans and Democrats anymore. What you have is an establishment, a plutocracy that is against the masses and against the people. And the Trump movement is really a grassroots movement, and it's a rebellion against the system. I think, Kamala Harris talked about in that interview how, you know, she wants to put a, you know, Republican administration, and how there was this border bill that, you know, conservatives supported. And to be clear, there was three. But this goes back to my point of neocons and neolibs. Mitch McConnell was one of the people to support that legislation. Mitch McConnell is on his way out because of Donald Trump. I mean, he is one of the most rancid, corrupt Republicans. And so I don't think people can look at things and say, oh, well, they're a Republican, they're a good guy. No. From my perspective, I always look at who's in power and who's calling the shots. And so, you know, when you look back at the last, you know, seven or eight elections and who's opposing the Trump administration, well, who was the candidate on the Republican side in 2008? It was John McCain. Who was the Republican candidate in 2012? Mitt Romney. But let's go back even further than that, right? Let's go back to 2004. It was George Bush and John Kerry, both members of Skull and Bones. You see George Bush, right, supporting the Kamala presidency, supporting the Biden presidency. John Kerry was in the Biden administration, because in each election, it didn't really matter which way, because the establishment had control of both sides. When you only have two parties, it is easy for the establishment to control both sides. And that's why we need a third party. We need a fourth party. But right now, you know, you don't have that. And so, and this is why you see the anti-establishment folks, people like Tulsi Gabbard, who I'd say is a real Democrat, right? A woman of color that fought for our country, a woman that believes in social safety nets, and RFK Jr., somebody that wants to go after companies like Monsanto and take the poison out of our foods and wants a clean environment, again, supporting the Trump administration. So I think the takeaway here, you know, of what we're really trying to communicate is that you have to look at the paradigm, you have to look at the results of policies, but the Trump administration is to the left of the Harris administration. I mean, that's why the neocons support her administration, the Ukrainian war, right? Like 95% of that money goes to the military-industrial complex. And so you can go back to 2008, Obama got elected and Robert Gates remained our defense secretary. So we went from two wars to seven. And people have to see through the mirage and see what's really going on. So there's no such thing as Republicans and Democrats. I mean, Liz Cheney, Adam Kissinger on a January 6th committee, they're not Republicans. They are what's left of the neocon establishment. And I think it really goes back to, for a long time, the establishment was trying to get control. They snuck H.W. Bush onto the Reagan ticket, right? And, you know, really since that, I mean, it started before that administration. I mean, you could really go back to, you know, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, of when the globalists really started to implement their plan. But since the administration of H.W. Bush, it's been heads we win, tails you lose. And so that's the goal of Orwellian Optics, to really talk about these things, to get you to see behind the curtain, much like at the end of The Wizard of Oz, right? Like, who's behind the curtain calling the shots? And before we go, I mean, the last thing I'll say here is that the people calling the shots, really calling the shots, it's, you know, if you think Donald Trump's a bad guy and a billionaire, well, then the people funding the Harris administration, you need to take a look at them. People like Klaus Schwab, were $20 billion. George Soros, $20 billion. Klaus Schwab's parents were members of the Nazi administration in Germany, and he made most of his money selling weapons to apartheid South Africa. So the real bad guys in the world stage are behind the politicians. The politicians are not the ones, they work essentially for this plutocracy. That's how they enrich themselves. The whole system is rancid. And Donald Trump is really the revolution against that system. And so as much as, you know, I'm not a fan of him on a personal level, for us, this is about policies and the policies that are going to, you know, drive the returns in your portfolio. And what we do as a company is really position our assets to really be prepared for whatever administration gets control. And with that, folks, that wraps up this episode of Orwellian Optics. We hope you found the discussion insightful. Don't forget to check us out at alleocapital.com. You could sign up and join our beta list. And don't forget to check us out on Apple Podcasts, YouTube Music, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you again for joining us. Peace and love. See you next time.
Thanks, everybody.